Hi, this is Paul. For a while now, I've wanted to really dig my teeth into this video. I saw this video before the Chino conference, and I just haven't had much of a chance to engage with it. I'll probably engage with it in some ways in parallel to Tom Holland's recent video, or not video, Tom Holland's recent podcast on The Rest Is History about democracy and demos, because it actually connects up quite well. There's so much good content in this particular episode of the Universal History series. This is probably, on Jonathan Peugeot's channel, my favorite series. This has just been an outstanding series. I really need to have Richard on the channel and just do a Randos conversation with him just to get to know him better, to understand the context of his life and his story and his work and all of that, so that all of these great conversations between Richard and Jonathan can be in better context. They start out because Richard notes that he's bumped into a number of people in the wild who have been talking about this series with him, and he wanted to sort of fine-tune it, recalibrate it for them. So again, there's sort of an on-ramp issue that he's trying to deal with. And so here he's going to give a little bit of introduction in terms of what they mean by mythic history or universal history. And I think understanding that what they're doing here is very much sort of mythic universal, that's helpful to understand universal in this section. So let's start there.
So the symbolic medieval universal history is, I'm looking down at my notes. It's a combination of let's call the Christian mythic content. And by mythic, obviously, I think everybody should know by now, I do not mean false, right? But Christian mythic content in the sense that it's a myth that we live into, a sacred story, etc. So there's a Christian mythic content, which is obviously the Bible. It's also the Apocrypha, by which I mean the actual Apocrypha, not the director's cut of the Bible. And then it's also like the lives of the saints, and then all the squiggly folklore traditions, weird stuff, you know, dog-headed saints and the head of Saint John the Baptist flying around haunting people, we were just talking about before the recording started, like stuff like that, like all that stuff that's kind of out there more on the margins of the tradition, that's all kind of part of this Christian mythic content.
Yeah,
so it's that plus,
okay, let's pause there. What modern history was supposed to do, this is part of the Enlightenment project, was either eliminate or pare down this mythic history. And the thought was, well, if we can only have real history, and again, what we meant by real history was history where there's sort of a physical evidence trail. That can be, think about court evidence. It can be physical evidence. It can be eyewitness testimony. But this has to be sort of physical evidence. And that then becomes, in the modern period, what history is. But this mythic history or universal history are sort of the stories out of which people live. And I think a big part of what has happened downstream of Jordan Peterson, what this little corner has majored in many ways, is the fact that the truth is we all live out of a story. We live out of a history and a tradition. And these stories, even if part of what develops, boy, this gets into a lot of what I talked about in my Sunday school class too this week. Part of what happens in the modern period is that there is a new way to evaluate each other socially with respect to, let's say, confessional adherence to physical correspondence. That's a horrible sentence. Basically, it means you gain status if you can act like all of the stories you tell have a layer of physical correspondence, and you lose status if the stories you tell don't seem to have that same level of physical correspondence. This plays out in the modernist fundamentalist fight in Western Christianity, where by virtue of a lot of science having been done, a lot of a lot of assumed relationship. See, this is so hard because it's not just, we don't know how ancient people thought about things. We assume they think about things in the same way we do. This is, in fact, what's behind a lot of the work that Tom Holland has done. So maybe it's better if I sort of shift gears and go back there. Okay, let's start the podcast here.
So that is the father of history, or the father of lies, depending on whom you believe, Herodotus, talking about how in 506 BC, the Athenians fought off an attempt by the Spartans and the Thebans, their rivals, to throttle a radical new system of government in its cradle. And that radical new system of government, Tom, was democracy, something that we all now think is splendid. But the Spartans thought it was an absolute waste of space.
And the Thebans too. I mean, basically everyone did. And the association of Athens with democracy, I guess it's probably, if you talk to people about ancient Athens, most people would think of it as the birthplace of democracy, and they would see it as a kind of democratic system. And Athens is basically the place where the notion of democracy is born. But I think that it's a treacherous word, because the question is, to what extent does what we mean by democracy map onto what the Athenians meant by democracy?
Okay, right there. Democracy. Oh, that's then there. And Tom Holland says, well, what we understand it to be and what they understand it to be are two different things. What are the things that make up our meanings of these words? And in many ways, they are the stories, the rituals, all of those things that are behind it, the deep assumptions that we bring to the world that are in our formation, our personal formation, our familial formation, our cultural formation, our religious formation, all of that brings in. Now, what we tend to do is we look to the past to orient ourselves to the future. And so, as Tom Holland notes, people in the modern period, during the modern period, you have, you know, questions about absolute, the divine right of kings. You have questions about monarchy. These questions by no means are going away. Even today, you know, monarchism, orthodoxy, monarchy, the emperor, all of these are conversations that are still alive today. And so then people pointed to, well, at the ancient Greeks invented democracy. And Tom Holland basically says, now, wait a minute. They probably didn't have in mind what we had in mind.
And I think that there is a huge temptation on our part to assume that they're basically the same things. And so we judge the Athenians by our standards. And so the thing that people will always say about Athenian democracy is, well, women didn't have the vote. Foreigners didn't have the vote. Slaves didn't have the vote. And underpinning that critique is, I think, the idea that democracy is founded on the idea of rights, that people have rights to votes.
Yeah.
And I think that actually the story of how democracy came to be born in Athens and what democracy meant is kind of stranger and weirder than that. And it kind of requires us to try and essentially kind of wipe away our own understanding of what democracy is and try and stand in shoes that are actually very strange.
Yeah, because
now this, you have to sort of do something funny with history. Because Tom Holland is using modernist history to say our easy breezy assumptions about the relationship between Athens and what we consider to be democracy, they actually don't connect. A modernist historian will say, look at what they wrote about, and we try to mind read them in the past to understand what they understood democracy to be, how they justified it compared to how we do today. You're living in two different worlds. Towards the end of the podcast, I'm going to have to look up the authors that he cites here, but he makes that point. Now, towards the end of the podcast,
you know, if Donald Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney are listening, this would be their sort of, with their Iraq war hats on, they would be saying, well, you know, democracy will one day sweep across the world. It's sort of Francis Fukuyama idea, I suppose. I know I'm describing it very simplistically. Why doesn't this spread? If this is such a brilliant idea, why, if it makes you better at fighting, why don't the Spartans, the Thebans, all these other people adopt it? Why is it?
Now, if you go back to when I had a conversation with Adam Friended years ago, and he sort of had this idea of sort of the the spirit of the nations being justified by the victory of its armies. The reason that we know that Western democracy is superior to the fascist way of going about politics, like Nazism or Franco or the communist way, because of the collapse of the communist world, the how things played out in the world is basically the justification. Now, if you go back to one of the great parts of this conversation, when they talk about the hand of God, you know that God's hand is on democracy because democracy wins. Now, of course, communists made a similar argument in their heyday. All of those arguments sort of have the weakness of sort of heyday validation.
That Athens remains an outlier.
Well, two things to say on that. First of all, the idea that, you know, the famous Martin Luther King quote that Obama was very fond of citing, that the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends towards justice. I mean, this is a very Christian idea. And right. So in that sense, the idea of progress is something that is a legacy of Christianity.
Not of Athenian democracy.
Absolutely not. Why doesn't it spread? Because it gets weaponized by the Athenians, and democracy comes to be associated with the Athenian Empire. And Athens comes to impose democracies on subject cities as a way of essentially institutionalizing its own power. But the other reason is that in the long run, it is felt by the kind of people who write the sources that have survived that democracy is a terrible thing. But actually,
now, in this way, anybody who's paid any attention at all to Plato's most famous work, the one that tends to get read, or at least used to get read regularly, even in a high school education, which is The Republic, that, you know, Plato's not, is by no means, means advocating a democracy of the golds and the silvers and the bronze. Plato isn't advocating democracy at all. Yet people are like always saying, well, we have to leap over the new atheists were always imagining, well, we have to leap over this Christian thing and get to the enlightenment. You can sort of lily pad your way all the way back to Athens and get democracy. And Tom Holland basically says nothing could be further from the case. And the way he does it is he goes through the universal history. But I want to get to the end here where he shares a couple of things. I believe it's at the end. I've listened to this twice. I'm going to listen to it again.
That actually power should be in the hands of people who are qualified to use it, people who are educated, and that the mass of the people are, you know, just a rabble.
To be fair, that's what most people have thought through most of history, right?
Completely. And so the collapse of the Athenian democracy in the Peloponnesian War, and then again before the Macedonians, people turn around and say, well, we told you so. So it comes to be seen as an experiment not worth repeating.
Right. So that tees up brilliantly my last question, which is, we now think that there is a tradition, a story of progress. So, you know, Athens, then there's that business in Iceland, you know, England, the mother of parliaments, the United States Congress, you know, Martin Luther King having his dream, that there is this story. Is there any sense in which we can talk of a continuity, a living tradition that goes through history in which...
No.
So basically you're saying that people pick up Athenian democracy later and try and pretend it's a model for them.
Athenian democracy, once people start reading about it in the Renaissance and after, again, it serves aristocratic elites as a terrible warning of what happens. So in the 17th century, Thomas Hobbes says people shouldn't be reading about this because it just encourages them to have ideas above their station. And he's thinking specifically about the English Revolution.
Yeah.
He feels that the example of Athenian democracy has fed into the kind of regicidal instincts of the radicals in the Civil War. And the same thing happens with the French Revolution, that conservatives feel that the influence of the study of Greek democracy on the French Revolution has been wholly negative. But as democracy in the modern sense comes to spread, so the understanding of democracy comes to improve, and people look back at Athens and start seeing it as a kind of, you know, a shining city on a hill.
Yeah.
You know, this is the great model.
But this is an invention.
Our relationship with the past is always creative.
Right.
You know, it's kaleidoscopic effect. In an era where systems of government have the name of democracy, it's inevitable that attitudes to the original democracy are going to change. But it's also inevitable that we will look back at that original democracy as a precursor to ours.
Yeah.
Whereas in fact, it's not at all. It's something very different.
Brilliant. What an interesting note on which to end, Tom. It's a fascinating...
All right, I didn't get the point in. Now I'm going to have to go searching for the point I wanted to make because he had a book reference and I didn't get the book reference the two times I've listened to it. Now, if you listen to the whole podcast, you get the universal history or the mythological history of democracy. And it's very interesting. It has to do with the gods. It also has to do with history and things that changed and how people look back into the past, how they construct their worldview at a very deep level, which is in many ways for all of us sort of pre-conscious.
That it actually proves to be incredibly successful. So that passage from Herodotus that you read at the beginning of the episode, that is celebrating the fact that the Spartans are unable to snuff out the democracy, even though they try to, and that Thebans get beaten in battle. And, you know, hurrah, the Athenian democracy has demonstrated not...
Okay, so if the Thebans lose in battle, it's sort of the hand of God showing that, well, the Athenians are right. And that's very common in the ancient world, that the power of the god is demonstrated by the power of the people, the instantiation of the people. You have Paul Kingsnorth talking and Jonathan Peugeot following Kingsnorth, basically talking about, you know, what does technology want? You see this in the Grail Country conversation with Sherry and Paul Kingsnorth. Well, the god is trying to instantiate itself. Well, these ancient worlds, Athenia, they're the children of Athena, even though they are really sort of from the sperm of Hephaestus that she wipes off her leg when he's sort of aroused by her and she puts her off. That's at the beginning of the podcast. This is a crazy story. I didn't even know that story. Out of which comes to the ground this man with a tail and on and on and on. Listen to the podcast. It's just an outrageous story.
Not only that it can hold its own, but that actually it can go on the attack. So there's a slight sense there of, you remember Goethe looking at the victorious armies of the French Revolution and thinking, you know, new forces have been unleashed by this process. But there is no celebration of the fact that this is new. That's the whole point. And so the question then is Cleisthenes and everybody making this?
So in other words, there's the story, the mythological history of the founding of Athens is used as justification for the practice within Athens. And today, you know, we tend to hail those things which are new, but there it's, no, this is old. These are our foundations. This is who we are.
Idea that the Athenians are autochthonous, that they're sprung from the soil up to kind of justify it, or is he going with the grain of things that the Athenians already believed? And it's obviously quite difficult to do that because our sources are so scanty. Mm. I mean, we have written sources, say, going back to Solon, not much before that. We have archaeology that does show that in, say, the 9th century, divisions between rich and poor in Attica are growing much stronger. But all the stuff about Theseus and Erechtheus, I mean, this is clearly not true. So where is it coming from? And I think that the difficulty...
Okay, clearly not true. And so part of the difficulty that when you listen to something like that, when you say clearly not true, well, what do we mean by that? Well, we've got all this mythological history and it's clearly not true because we don't have, you know, we don't believe that Hephaestus is sort of, you know, jonesing for Athena, the virgin goddess, and wants to rape her, and in his excitement, you know... Gosh, these myths jizzes on her and then she wipes it off and then the rag. I mean, again, Tom sort of navigates that whole thing at the beginning of the show with a lot of delicacy, a little more delicacy than I just did. But I just want to make it plain what the assertion is and say, well, that's not real, but okay. Zeus is real. Santa Claus is real. What do we mean by real? Real enough to found an Athenian democracy.
That historians have in making sense of this is precisely that, what I was saying at the beginning of this episode, that it's difficult for us to get back into a mindset where we can have any sense of what demos meant to the Athenians. Because it's not the people in the way that, you know, we might use it today, the people's party or the people's choice or the people say this. It's much, much weirder, I think, than that.
It always is with you, Tom. It's never less weird. I pine. I look forward to the day when you do an episode and you say the true story is much less strange and in no way weird.
So this is one of the key reasons why I ended up writing Dominion, was the difficulty of getting to grips with what demos actually meant to the Athenians, because the whole idea that it's rights-based is an absolute nonsense. So, but what does demos mean? And the reason why it's hard for us...
Now, again, of course, well, I can play the video.
We'll start with Gavin at the front here. Questions, not statements. We haven't got much time. Thank you.
Now, I want to throw back to Tom a question he once asked me, but I'd like him to answer it. Tom, once we had a small discussion, you said the very distinctive thing about the church was that, as you quite just said, it really does believe in good and evil. It's nothing if it doesn't have a metaphysical vision. Most of the people here, I think, would sign up to that metaphysics. One difficulty we have is persuading a highly secularized society that our metaphysical vision isn't something at the level of Victorian fairy tales. As someone who straddles both worlds, do you have any advice for us in the way in which we can reacquaint our society with the seriousness of what is almost a dualistic metaphysical narrative in order to catch their imagination sufficiently for us to be able to tell the Christian story with effect?
Well, I think the key is for people in the West to be culturally humble and to recognize that their values are not universal, as I said. So another one would obviously be human rights. Because the West has been so hegemonic for so long, it's been in a position to assume that its concept of human rights is somehow universal. They don't need to think about it. Of course human rights exist. But what the rise of China and of other civilizational powers is doing is to remind us that the concept of human rights is one that has emerged in a very specific cultural matrix, which is a Christian one, and that therefore...
And that cultural matrix is made up in many ways of this mythological universal history.
If you want to believe in human rights, you have to believe. It takes a leap of faith to believe that there are things called human rights, just as much as it takes a leap of faith to believe that the Lord Jesus Christ raised from the dead. They're both beliefs. And the fact that most people in the West sign up to the fact that human rights exist and that they're important and that they should determine, say, national policy, public policy, actually, it's as rooted in theology and myth and metaphysics as all the teachings of Christianity. And I think that once people are reminded of that, I think it becomes impossible not to feel a kind of greater sense of where, what Christianity is about. Because, if you believe in human rights, why not believe that Jesus rose from the dead? You might as well hang for a sheep as a lamb. I think that it reminding people that the core beliefs that are fundamental to how people morally define themselves is rooted in faith reopens the possibility for secularists to recognize that they have not kind of emancipated themselves from the need for faith. They continue to illustrate it. And I think that kind of contemplating that then reopens the possibility to think, well, where might this practice of believing in fantastical things lead? But I think one of the things that the churches need to do is to kind of absolutely embrace this rather than being slightly embarrassed about it and only talking about the kind of things that you'd hear on a Liberal Democrat Party political broadcast, which is a kind of, thought for the day thing.
And he talks about that in my conversation with him. You're going to have to come to terms with what exactly makes up this sacral ecosystem. I haven't been doing much with my Substack lately. My apologies. That sort of rose out of a certain workflow. But one of the things that I had written, the word keeps becoming flesh and won't sit still for the autopsy. And it was one of the great things about doing the event was I got to meet Senior Saboya. Got to hang out with Senior Saboya a little bit because Senior Saboya had made this great comment. I haven't watched the new series, but plan to do so by this weekend. What you said about Jews reaching Torah via legal path and normies reaching the Bible via cultural hodgepodge rings true for me. I was just talking with my mother over the holiday about her connection to the church, the faith, and the Bible. Naturally, I've heard some of what she said my whole life, but it had never struck me how the structure of her faith is almost sedimentary. Layer after layer of affirming deposits have been laid over her lifetime. Having never made a concerted study of these matters, she seems to have developed and maintained a set of ideas over her life that somehow opened spiritual doors for her. It's idiosyncratic and very personal. It's what's proven to work for her. And it very much has everything to do with universal history and how the sense-making that we do always involves narrative. And unlike sort of this court case where you're going to, and what's amazing is that towards the end of the 20th century and the beginning of the 21st, even apologetics birth, you think about Lee Strobel and the case for God, you know, everything was just sort of in a court case. People don't arrive at their beliefs after some court case. They bring their beliefs to the court. And now everybody sort of wanted to put their beliefs on trial. C.S. Lewis, God in the dock, all of this stuff. Well, that's just not how people put it together.
Athena, who is a virgin, is also a mother and a queen and a guardian. And that this is somehow, to the Athenians, kind of real. And so that passage that you read from the children's book, I think in that book, I get closer to it than I did in Persian Fire, actually.
Yeah.
Because I think that the demos is, it's the entire...
Now, that's really interesting that he can get closer to it in the children's book. I haven't looked up his children's book now yet, but if it's available in the U.S., I'm definitely going to order it, because it's interesting, again, that C.S. Lewis wrote, you know, what I believe is a wonderful apologetics book, Miracles. You see me talk about it on my channel often. Really love the book. But he pivots to children's books. And I think he pivots to children's books for this reason, that you really can't construct sort of this sedimentary layer without all of this universal history. Because the truth is, the vast majority of history that you assume to know and stories you know, we talked at the conference about the way memory works. And John Vervaeke was quite clear. Memory is this, it's just in time, pulling back from the past what you need right now, and you reconstruct it for right now. That's why memory is in many ways sort of fallible. But universal history is sort of like a collective history of a nation moving forward, leaning forward to what they need now.
It's the entirety of all the people in Athens who have been born, who are living, and who will be born in the future.
Very Burkean idea there, Tom.
Kind of. It's absolutely distinct from the flesh and blood Athenians who are going to the assembly or whatever.
It's more kind of spiritual than that.
Yeah. But even spiritual is the wrong word. We don't really have the vocabulary to describe it. It's kind of like the turning of the seasons, that every year the season turns and the earth gives birth to vines and to wheat. The same thing is happening with the people. The people have that kind of relationship to the soil. And I think the thing that illustrates this most interestingly is what the attitude of the democracy is to women, because it's the role of women that is traditionally the most controversial. It's the thing that people always fix on, women didn't have the vote. And it's often said that women didn't rank as citizens in the democracy, but this isn't true. So politeis is the Greek word for citizen, but there is politis, which is the female form of it. So there is absolutely a sense that women are kind of citizens as well. And you say, but they're not citizens, they didn't have the vote. They don't have the vote, but they still have a role that, in the opinion of the Athenians, is just as important as that of the men. So the men have the vote because it is their responsibility to draw up the laws and to fight. That's their role. Their role is to deal with the affairs of man, to keep the democracy functioning in terms of state relations, relations with enemies, rebuilding alliances, taking measures that will keep the democracy functioning. But the role of women is just as important, because without children, there is no demos. And so the legal definition of an Athenian is someone who is born from a male and a female Athenian. And so the womb of an Athenian woman, it's a kind of simulacrum of the soil of Attica. It's where the demos springs from. Women are the closest approximation to the sacred earth of Attica. And, you know, that may not impress people today, but to the Athenians, I think it gave to women a sense of kind of uncanniness. And that sense of uncanniness is heightened by the fact that it is basically women rather than men who have responsibility for the dimension of the supernatural, for keeping the demos in balance with the dimension of the gods. And so the Panathenaea, which the Athenians traced back to the time of Theseus and then ultimately back to Erechtheus, the kind of the founder of Athens, it's women who take the lead role in this. they are the people who stand at the head of the procession. They are the ones who weave this great robe, which every 4 years is taken up and adorns the statue of Athena on the top of the Acropolis. It's women who have responsibility for the cult of Erechtheia, say, on the Acropolis. And you may say, well, this is all just flim-flam and mumbo-jumbo.
Yeah.
But to the Athenians, it isn't.
Okay, so just to jump in and anticipate what some of the listeners may think.
Okay, and right here you get to the business about what on earth, how did our understanding of history change?
So listening to you talking about this, saying, oh, well, they don't have the vote, but they do all this. So, you know, when there were the great controversies about women's suffrage at the turn of the 20th century in Britain and America and so on, people who opposed women's suffrage would often say, well, the vote and politics is properly the domain of men, and women have their own things, which are just as important. And let's not muddy the two. You know, women do lots of other. So in other words, they would make those kinds of arguments. But you're saying, but there would have been nobody, you're saying, in, you know, 6th century Athens or whatever, there weren't women who were saying, this is all nonsense. And actually, I would like the vote, and the vote is more important than being at the head of a procession or whatever.
Well, there might be. I mean, we don't know. So firstly, the difference between, say, the suffragette Britain and Athens is that nobody in Athens had any notion that a vote is reflective of a right. I mean, that's what we've been saying throughout. That's not what has motivated it. And so that's not what's going on. And secondly, people in Edwardian Britain might turn around and say, oh, well, you know, the home is the proper sphere of a woman. That's just as important. But that's not giving to women the incredibly potent role that the Athenians understand women as playing.
Right.
Because women, by basically negotiating with the gods, the protection of the gods has, you know, it's kind of like an insurance policy.
Yeah.
And things have to be done correctly. The correct rituals have to be carried out. The gods have to be kept happy. And if they're not, then the democracy will collapse and Athens will collapse.
Yeah.
And so men are engaged in dealing with the Thebans and the Spartans, and women are engaged in taking robes up to Athena on the Acropolis, or going to Brauron, a temple of Artemis on the coast, and doing rituals there. Many people who are very young, so girls, before they hit puberty, go out there, and it said, turn into bears. And that's one of the things that happens in my book. And again, I think writing for children, you can make this kind of stuff much more vivid, because you can say that this actually happens, that the gods do actually exist. And then the moment you accept that the gods do exist, then the jeopardy becomes that much greater. I think because we don't believe in the gods. But not just that we don't believe in gods, but we don't have the mindset that enables us to understand what it is to exist in the late 6th century and exist in a world where the dimension of the divine and the supernatural is all around you and has to be negotiated.
Yeah, because there'll be people listening to this who still will be saying, but the gods didn't exist. The roles that were given to women were nonsense. You know, they should have had the vote. It's a disgrace. I suppose you're saying it's an unsatisfying and ultimately fruitless way to try and understand the world of the 6th century if you insist on asserting your 21st century mindset.
If you think of, you know, looking through a glass darkly back at this kind of ancient and obscure period, there are two kind
of... It's interesting that he picks that metaphor, of course, from 1 Corinthians 13.
Two kind of great smears of dirt across the glass. One is the fact that we don't believe in the gods anymore. And increasingly, people don't believe in, you know, have a very materialist approach. The whole essence of writing history is fundamentally materialist. We don't say, you know, this happened because the gods wanted it to happen or whatever.
Yeah.
Historians who are writing, say, at universities or whatever, are entirely materialist in their approach.
Mm-hmm.
And the second smear of dirt across the glass is this kind of Christian idea that every individual has a value by virtue of being created in the image of God. And that is what underpins, I think, our ideal of democracy. The idea that people have rights to votes.
But the Athenians absolutely didn't think this.
They don't have that. There's a book written by a great scholar called Greg Anderson, who wrote a wonderful book about the emergence of Greek democracy. But he then wrote a kind of altogether weirder book called The Realness of Things Past, which essentially is about exactly this theme. Basically, how the entire structure or the academic structure of writing history prevents us from getting to grips with how weird it was.
Yeah.
And how strange.
There's the hitch. Well, we want to write history about, we sort of concordist, physicalist history. Well, the history that you're writing about is moved by the upper register. And, well, can you simply mind read the upper register? And the answer is, we're really unsure.
Strange it was. And oddly, it's one of the things, you know, that's absolutely one of the things that inspired me to write that children's book, was that thinking that if I can write an account of it in which the gods exist, in a sense, I'm getting closer to explaining it
yeah.
than I would by writing a kind of scholarly monograph that strips bare all the sources and deconstructs them.
So it reminds me a little bit of, we had a...
It's right there. This darn actor keeps showing up when you search Tom Holland if you can't find what you're looking for. Number one question, is Tom Holland related to Tom Holland? Oh, gosh. Here it is, Tom Holland, the wolf girl, the Greeks, and the gods. UK import. We'll see if it comes to the United States. Well, there it is. You can get it through Amazon in the States. Okay, back to the symbolic world.
God, and it ends with me. So you have God, right? And then you have the sort of like the almost parallel streams. And I realize there's a whole very long-running historical debate about who has priority, the Pope or the Emperor or whatever. Or if you're in the East, you've got the Patriarch and the Emperor. But in any case, you know, you've got God, and then you've got the Pope or the Patriarch and the Emperor. And then down from there, you have these various increasingly localized principalities. So if we're talking about the church, then you've got under the Patriarch, you've got like, there's the holy, you know, there's your local bishop. And then under your local bishop, there's the priest that he's basically deputized to act on his behalf, like all the way down to you. And then if you're talking about that on a national level, I mean, it's not for nothing that the original like diocesan structure of the, like a diocese is a Roman imperial like division of geography and people. Like, so like the original like metropolitan diocesan structure of the church in the early centuries was basically, they just used what the Roman Empire kind of already had in place, right? Yeah. So that you would have these increasingly local nested identities that are basically parallel.
Yeah, so it's important because, you know, when a lot of modern historians, when they notice the gestures, for example, that some local, what they would call a warlord, makes towards the emperor, who is like so far away and they have nothing to do with, they tend to dismiss that as just irrelevant and just words. But if you understand the way that people saw identity, then you can see that, no, this gesture is very relevant to how they anchor everything together and make everything make sense in their world.
Yeah.
Okay. So what Jonathan just said is super important because these gestures, again, as Jonathan just said, anchor everything together and make sense in the world. The whole business of Athena and Hephaestus and the little incident with the sexual arousal and excitement and the rag and the demos and all of that, that's how they make sense of their world. We make sense of our world. The reason we use narrative is because narrative is this vastly powerful compression. It's a compression algorithm. You can think about it that way, in which we take all four P's, because narrative has as the perspectival, the participatory, the propositional. It takes all those four P's and it binds it together in a small enough package that even children, as children grow up, they can begin to live within this world. And so in many ways, what we're getting at with this mythological history, universal history, are the connections that are tying the world together between peoples, and especially tying these peoples who are far away biologically, let's say, from events in the ancient Near East and Egypt and the Sinai and in Israel and in Babylon and in Rome and in Ephesus and in Corinth, that tie them together to these places.
Yes. So in the way that worked for like worldly power structures or ecclesiastical power structures, it also works for stories. So at the top or the outside, you have this... and the other thing to say about that you know, social ecclesiastical hierarchy is that there are holy people. A good example would be like your local patron saint, right? Holy people sort of exist outside or kind of bridge the hierarchy in unexpected ways. So if you live in a small medieval village...
Now let's talk about this holiness, because the hermeneutic of suspicion tends to be, well, that's just because they had power, or that's just because it was superstitious, or that's just because it was popular, or that's just because there was a paucity of available heroes, and so the local village turned into that one. Now, of course, there are almost always connections between them, but heroism is all about effectiveness in terms of bringing together dead reckoning good outcomes. Okay, what do I mean by dead reckoning? This came up a few times in the conference. Dead reckoning is sort of this very low resolution, very imminent, very personal idea of whether something is good or bad, is right track or wrong track, is heading in the right direction or heading in a wrong direction. And people navigate according to this dead reckoning sense all the time. And sometimes their dead reckoning sense that can lead them into disastrous places. Let's say there's a con man, and this con man is, let's say, approaching this senior citizen or this young woman and seems to be offering things that are going to make their life better. Or a drug pusher does this. Here's a free little sample. Try this and see if it makes your life better. Maybe things are tough at home and there's no way to really escape. And if you just take this drug for a half hour or something, suddenly all your problems go away and everything feels wonderful and you feel powerful, you feel godlike, and then it's like, wow, that was awesome. Let me get some more of that. But that dead reckoning is going to lead you in a bad direction. So there's the dead reckoning, and then we're continually doing it, and over time we sort of try to piece all of the pieces together to get a worldview that will be more reliable than just the instantaneous. So a local hero is someone that has shown competency, effectiveness, power, and of course, connected to the gods. Now, one of the best things that John Vervaeke said at the conference was, in many ways, materialism as being inverted Neoplatonism. And once he said that, it was like, bang. Oh, wow. That's really interesting, because I think one of the videos I want to make, sort of following up on my Sunday school class this week, was that part of what happens in modernity with the modernist fundamentalist impulse is that God number one sort of goes away. God number two gets enlarged, and increasingly God becomes a super thing in the sky. And I've talked about that a lot. And that's so easy to debunk, because it's this really bad definition of God. And you hear people playing with it in many ways. You know, the God is the ground of being. And there's all these sort of definitional God's no-thingness. When you listen to John Vervaeke talk about it, I know a lot of people sort of react harsh to that. But Jonathan Peugeot says a similar thing. And I think if you listen to Bishop Barron carefully, God is not a thing along with all the other things in the world. It has to do with the definition of things, what a thing is. And God is not like any other thing in the world, which is actually the foundation of the third commandment. You shall not make for yourself a graven image or anything that is above, heavens above or in the earth below. Why? Because you cannot reduce God to something that which is a creation of God. God is the source of this. Source is one way. God is above and beyond this. And so that's one of the issues.
In Central Europe or something like this, you know, you've got the emperor and the patriarch and everything way up here, way up above you. But then, like, there's also your local patron saint. Maybe it's St. Nicholas, right? So, like, if things are really getting out of hand, you have a path of, like, appeal, let's say, right? You can go to St. Nicholas. And he can go around, I mean, you know, he can go around the Pope or the Patriarch or the Emperor or whatever, and to kind of like help you out in your situation. So you've got holy people. And of course, the problem with modern people trying to understand this is we all want to be the person who's outside the hierarchy.
Okay, so let's first talk about how the holy people function. The holy people, well, they've clearly demonstrated their competency and their excellency and their connectedness to that which rules the world. And so this happens in politics all the time. So Sacramento is a very political city. Politics works via relationships. Everything with human beings works via relationships. As much as we want to sort of establish this veneer of process and equality, we all know that all of that is an attempt. It's always held in tension with all of these relationships. And if you want to get something done, find someone who has a relationship with the power that can wield, whether it's political authority or military authority or some kind of authority. And so a holy person is very important because it's the person that you know.
Right. And it doesn't, you know, but it's really just the holy people. And when I say holy, really hear that not just in a sense of this is a good person or a nice person, but that in the sense that this person is sanctified or set apart, because there's also such a sort of a thing as, let's say, the secular holy person, which I'll come back to in a minute. Mm-hmm. Right. Secular in the holy person, in the sense that somebody's like a secular, but they're set apart And because they're set apart, they're also sort of operating outside the normal hierarchy of things.
Yeah, so it's in some ways, there are ways in which the hierarchies, these are, how can I say it? Like in terms of a system, it's like fail safes in the hierarchy.
Yes.
Yeah, that's the way to, I mean, it's not as simple as that, but it's a good way for people to understand why the hierarchies are never, even when we talk about hierarchy, they're never just this simple top-down thing. They have a kind of variability and ways to shortcut when things go wrong along the hierarchy itself.
Actually, so before we started the recording, we were talking about the Arthurian stories a little bit, and the knight errant is a good example of that kind of a person in that sort of story, right? Because they have this role that puts them outside the normal hierarchy. So they show up in like a baron's district, and the baron is evil and he's awful and he's oppressing people. And it's like, well, where's the king? Why doesn't the king know about what's going on? But actually the knight errant, he has a pipeline to the king, right? So he's here from the round table. He's here from the king's court, and he sets things right. And then he goes back, right? He goes back to the court when it's over. So anyway, that's an example of that kind of thing. So if this is true for, like, you could say social, ecclesiastical hierarchies, it's also true for the hierarchy of stories when we're talking about universal history. So we start with this kind of one grand foundational story, which is sort of mythic, the mythic.
Okay, this part is running out of time. This part is really important. Ugh.
Content of Christianity plus Rome, right? That's the ground foundational story into which you have these increasingly localized identity conferring patterns. The story of, well, now here's the story of my people when we converted. And then beyond that, you might have, here's the story of my city or my village. And then beyond that, you have like, here's my family history, all the way down to, this is how my parents raised me. Hmm. And all of that stuff. And of course, what I'm really describing is the idea of tradition.
Yeah.
Right. All of that stuff confers identity at all these different levels, but it has the capability to kind of.
And again, there's sort of a sedimentary layer, the sedimentary effect that these stories have. There's very much a hierarchy of stories. There's a hierarchy of the world. There's a hierarchy of powers. And over time, it's important to understand how all these little stories fit together.
Each of those levels to be nested. And obviously, there are certainly places that converted. I mean, this is why we actually kind of started the series with Ethiopia, right? Is because there are places that converted that were outside the Roman Empire. So in that case, they're actually like the best proof case for like how this works, because it's not like they had any like political, you know.
Yeah, they had no political reason to play this game at all.
Right,
or the Armenians in the same way.
Yeah, another great example.
They had no reason, because people always say that it's just Constantine and Rome. And
right.
It's like, we have several case examples where that seems to not be the case.
Okay, and what this also shows, and why the title Universal History rather than Mythological History, and in some of the earlier videos had sort of mythological history on them, is that their argument using something like Ethiopia is that Ethiopia was sort of outside of the traffic patterns of the kingdom, of the Empire of Rome. And what this points to is that beneath, let's say, the more idiosyncratic, the stories of the Roman Empire were themselves, even though they're nested, they're a different layer, they're like an intermediate nesting, there was much more common understanding among and between empires and peoples that was deeper. Now, this is super important to the argument today, because essentially what's been going on in this little corner, to go all the way back to Jordan Peterson and to look at John Vervaeke and the integration of science, is because science was promoted by the Enlightenment as the new universal platform through which the world could once again be united. And now science itself is way too thin, and John Vervaeke's talked about this, and Peugeot's talked about this. You cannot prove science with science. John Vervaeke says that all the time. You can't prove science with science. Now, science rests on something else. And so part of when we get to the end of modernity, that faith in science is sort of receding along too. Skepticism about all sorts of science things, that doesn't mean science itself goes away. It's just that it has to be integrated into a more universal pattern. And so when you look at the shape of, let's say, Jordan Peterson's Exodus seminar, his Genesis series, all of this is in many ways a contemporary attempt to get back to some sense of universal history or a universal system. Now, it's not as overtly framed and shaped like narrative like these stories. It's more complex, and partly because one way of understanding science and math is that these are different language systems that don't necessarily operate like narrative and story, and only sort of the high priests of science or math sort of understand that, but yet most people are going to be continuing to use narrative, which is why people don't operate like, let's imagine you would assert that people may only act in the world on the basis of information derived with, let's say, an evidence-based court. And this is sort of what the new atheists tried to promote, that they said, no, we're only going to start from first principles and derive it. And it's like, hey, it can't be done. It can't be done. And we've talked about all sorts of philosophical movements that have pointed that out. Thomas Nagel, Wilfred Sellers, a lot of the talk about that, when John Vervaeke notes that you can't found science on science. It needs to be, it itself is dependent on something. C.S. Lewis runs through some of those things in his book Miracles and some of his other writing. This doesn't work. And so when you look at sort of the operating system of human beings, narrative itself remains sort of the most significant, let's call it machine code for us. Now, Vervaeke makes the point that we sort of achieve this come 3 or 4 years old. There have been attempts in modernity to set aside things like melody, sort of traditional narrative, all of this. And basically where we are is a throwing away of that. So Algo served up for me this video by Thomas Flight. Damon Walter did a response to it. It's an excellent video about the metamodern. And he gets into the point that, well, modernism was sort of this scientistic surety of a whole bunch of stuff that's, for the most part, just kind of inherited from Christianity and even more broadly, classical universal history. And that was the way stories were told.
Agree on what exactly they are and how to best describe them. Some people refer to modernism, postmodernism, and metamodernism as eras of thought, philosophy, or even art movements. Some academics refer to these three as structures of feeling, and that's the sense in which I'm going to be using them in this video. A structure of feeling is essentially a culture-wide vibe that encompasses philosophy, politics, design, and most importantly for this video, art. So in the case—
Now, I would assert that under art and a culture-wide vibe, so much of that underneath is simply narrative. We nest our scientific factoids in narrative selectively. We're doing all that relevance realization. And so even the way that we're shaping history moving forward in terms of our memory is all just in time, at hand, for the moment, et cetera, et cetera.
In the case of modernism, we're giving a name to a specific culture-wide vibe that starts to show up in philosophy with Descartes as early as the 1600s, and then continues through to Nietzsche, but which really shows up in culture and art from the 1900s to the 1940s. Film itself is a modernist medium. The technology started to emerge right as modernism was hitting the culture.
And part of the reason film is so modern is that it is monofocal. Almost right away when I started making videos, I talked about a monarchical vision. Film is all about directing a monarchical vision. It, in fact, Film is all about attention. The director directs your attention to this or that, and does so in a nuanced, symbolic way, in a multi-fashioned way.
Sure. In the same way science and reason seemed to provide a more objective view of reality than tradition did, photography seems to provide a more objective image of the world than paintings did. And in a sense, film being 24 photos a second presented the most startlingly real and immersive images art had ever been able to create. I think
And especially while our access to these things were very, very limited, it very much shot up the hierarchy. Said, oh, that's really real because that's a picture. If I'd only see a picture of Bigfoot or the Loch Ness Monster or of some atrocity around the world, a picture of the Holocaust, then I would know it. The more pictures we saw, the more we began to realize that, well, photographic evidence is certainly something to be dealt with. Now, that's going away with respect to AI and Photoshop and all of those things. Photographic evidence is something to be dealt with. How on earth can we actually capture the Great Depression? And right away, probably in many of your minds, iconic, look at the language, iconic images come to mind, and you say the Great Depression looks like that woman worrying about feeding her children. The Holocaust looks like the film Schindler's List. But we begin to discover that, hey, wait a minute, there's the selection issue involved in all of these films, and the way they make films is that these directors shoot very intentionally to deliver to us what? Sort of a pre-conscious feeling. And universal history is what all of this was made up before. It was all made up of storytelling.
This way, the form of film kind of ideologically aligned with modernist philosophies that promoted this idea of an objective view of reality. So in a lot of ways, I think modernism is kind of the...
And you know, even with that shot from... you know, Washington, D.C., well, now you're looking at, you know, you're looking at this huge statue of Abraham Lincoln. You're looking basically at a conceptualization of a president of the United States set into, if you took someone from ancient Greece and plopped them in the 20th century into Washington, D.C., after the Lincoln Memorial was constructed, he'd say Temple of Zeus. You know, Abe needs to be, you know, holding a lightning bolt. I am out of time. So all my, you know, someone made a comment at the conference, like after listening to my talk, it's like, oh, wow, that was different. Yeah, because these videos are, I've got an hour or an hour and a half, and I've got some thoughts, and I'm going to put them down. I'm going to share some resources with you, and my sentences are going to be unfinished. That's what you get. Sorry, that's what you get. If you want sort of a nice tailored thing, well, those are more what you get at a conference. So leave a comment. Let me know what you think.